Well, good afternoon, everybody. And I'm gonna wait a little bit to see if everybody gets on. I think there's plenty of people already on, so thank you for the first of what will be hopefully many of these to come. So I'm really excited to do this. It's something new for all of us, and really excited to take advantage of this technology and bring the wine into your house and what we do with the wines and explain why the wines are as good as they are. So thanks again for joining. And I know I said I was going to wait, but I'm going to keep talking because I can't stop. If you have any questions, please, it'd be great if this was as interactive as possible. And so if you have any questions, I'll answer those at the end of the presentation on the wine. And I'd love to answer any questions you may have. You know, we're an open book here, open story, no secrets. And I think the more you know about the wines and how they're made, the more you will appreciate them. So I would appreciate any questions or even comments. And I'll get to those at the end when I can get a hold of my trusty iPhone to read the questions coming at me. So again, thanks. Thanks for coming. So I think I'm gonna go ahead and get started. I see that I've got a fair number of people online already, so no use in waiting. And basically, the way I'm gonna start is I wanna talk a little bit about the wines that I'm gonna be presenting today and tomorrow and Friday, and we're gonna repeat that again in a couple of weeks. Because I know a lot of you don't have the wines, and maybe some of you do, and it would be great to do this with people actually having the wine in front of them. So, again, we're gonna do it in a couple of weeks, and we selected these three different wines. We started this program called the Sip While You Sip program, and it was kind of a little funny way of taking advantage of the shelter in place that we're all in. And coincidentally, the SIP is Sip. So, we hope that you're doing plenty of sipping while you're sheltering in place and you're keeping safe at home. The point of it for us is we decided to release these three different wines. We're doing the Chardonnay today. Tomorrow we'll do a Pinot Noir, and on Friday we'll do a Cabernet Sauvignon. And these three represent a little bit a bigger production than what we usually do with the other wines. So most of the time we're doing anywhere between 50 and 300 cases of wine, and these three wines represent our core product with a little bit more production. And by a little bit, you know, it's not a huge amount. It's about 800 cases that we're doing of this. And we thought in order to help out our community, which I'm sure it's happening all across the country, a lot of restaurants being closed and people being out of work because of the restaurant closures and restaurants having a hard time, we thought that this would be a pretty good way for us to help our community that is a very tight-knit community here with the restaurants and the support that we get from the restaurants. So we decided to do this Sip While You Sip program and offer these three wines at up to a 40% discount and using some of the proceeds from the wines that we sell to help these people out from the restaurants and whatnot. So hopefully, and the hotels too that are suffering here as well. So hopefully, you know, it's something you can help us with so we can help other people and we can all enjoy some really good wine. So with that, let's get started on the Chardonnay. And this is we call it our Napa Valley Chardonnay. It actually comes from a single vineyard. Almost everything that we do is, I'm sure you're well aware, is single vineyard, single varietal, with one exception currently, which is the Jimmy D's. And another exception that we did in the past is a Cabernet that we blended, which we'll taste on Friday. Almost everything is single vineyard, single varietal. And that's kind of what we do here. For those of you who have been to Napa, I'm sure you've seen what a small place it is, but it's very diverse. And so our proximity to the San Francisco Bay on the south end of the valley, and the narrowness of the valley allows us to have these different microclimates within the valley. And so that allows us to grow different varietals that maybe you wouldn't see growing next to each other. And then maybe if you were to go to France, you'd have to go find Chardonnay next to Cabernet, let's say, you know. So we have this really special region where we can grow these different grapes, and we have very subtle differences in climate within the valley that allows us to have different characteristics in the wine. So even though this is Chardonnay from the Oak Knoll appellation, it's not from Carneros. We make another wine that's Chardonnay that comes from the Carneros vineyard that's owned by the same grower as this, Larry Hyde. This is, you know, as the crow flies, it's about 5 minutes from Carneros, but the difference in climate is such, and the difference in soil is such, that you get a much different expression of the Chardonnay grape than you do in Carneros. So this is the same clone of Chardonnay, and a clone is basically a variation on the theme of the varietal. So think of it in terms of apples. You have red apples, you have green apples, you have Granny Smith, you got Fuji. They're all apples, and we have the same thing within grape varietal. So it's the same clone as the other Chardonnay that we produce. but it grows in a different soil in a different place. And the vineyard that produces this wine, and for those of you that were able to tap into my inaugural Instagram live video, the vineyard was planted in 97, so it's going on 23 years this year, which is a pretty long time for a vineyard, especially for Chardonnay. And so it's planted, it's in the Oak Knoll Appellation, like I mentioned, so that's basically at the really north end of the town of Napa, basically on a corner close to the east side of the valley where the Silverado Trail meets Trancas Road. And so the name of the vineyard is Las Trancas because of its location. And so this vineyard has a really heavy, we call it Yolo loam soils. Yolo is another county here in California. And one of the things that that's interesting about the Napa Valley is that we have such a diversity of soils from that show up in other parts of the state just within this really small reality that we call the Napa Valley. So this Yolo loam is more akin to the soil that we find in Yolo County, which is not too far from where we are. It's basically on the other side of the Vaca mountain range on the east side of the valley. And so this soil with this particular clone produces a Chardonnay that's exactly what I was hoping for. So the idea behind this Chardonnay, in contrast to our High Vineyard Chardonnay, which is a much more traditional barrel-oaked, full malolactic Chardonnay, this is meant to be more of a stainless steel, fresher, no malolactic Chardonnay. And so the malolactic aspect, for those that don't know what that is, basically there's two fermentations that happen in wine, and some wines go through both, some wines only go through one. The first one is the alcoholic fermentation, and that's a yeast that converts sugar into alcohol. So all wines pretty much go through some degree of that, if not all the way through, to convert all the sugar to alcohol. And then the secondary fermentation is a bacteria that converts one acid into another type of acid. So the acid that it converts, it basically changes malic acid, which is the same acid you find in apples, and the Latin root of the word malic, mela is apple in Latin, and there's a lot of malic acid in apples, and that's where that comes from. Basically converts malic acid into lactic acid, which is the same acid you find in milk, lactic. And that results in a softer, smoother wine, less acid, maybe more dense, more viscous, and brings on the buttery character that a lot of people, I'm sure, know that's typical in Chardonnay, or at least in California Chardonnay. So the idea behind this wine was to not go through that malolactic fermentation and not have the buttery characters, but still retain more of the freshness that you get from this acid, the higher acid content. Now, what's interesting about this vineyard is this Yolo loam soil in this particular situation produces a Chardonnay that basically there's two acids that are predominant in grapes, tartaric acid and malic acid. And sometimes you have a lot of malic acid, sometimes you have very little, sometimes it's more tartaric than malic, which is usually the case. In the case of this vineyard, we have a lot of malic acid and not a lot of tartaric. And why is that important? Tartaric acid is a lot more aggressive on the palate. It comes across much more sharp and much more acid tasting than malic acid. Malic acid is a softer acid. And when you compare the chemistries between the two, the malic acid shows up with a much softer sensation on the palate with the same type of pH that you might have with tartaric acid. And I know that's getting a little crazy on the chemistry, but that's basically what it is. So with my goal of not going through a malolactic fermentation, I wanted to have access to fruit that had more malic acid and less tartaric, so that the wine, without going through the malolactic fermentation, still remained crisp, but not so searingly sharp as you might expect it if it was predominantly tartaric acid, or if it hadn't gone through malolactic at all with a high degree of malic. And so that vineyard selection for me was fundamental in being able to produce this kind of wine. Now, the second aspect of this wine is the way, so the harvest criteria for this wine, like most of the whites and all the wines in general, is flavor. But in the case of the white wines, I'm looking to harvest much sooner, with maybe even I can tolerate a little bit of unripeness in the wine, because I know it'll result in a much more fresh wine in the end. Compared to red wines, I want to have perfect ripeness, and we can talk about that when we do the red wines later this week. There's a chemical decision, and technically, there's phenolic ripeness, which has to do with the flavor compounds being ripe. And then there's what's called the technical ripeness, which has to do with the chemistry of the wine and the sugar and the acids being where you want them to be. So I look more towards a technical ripeness on this, so that I'm harvesting at a much lower sugar level, and that results in less alcohol, but also a fresher wine with a little bit more acidity. So we harvest at night, like everything, bring in the grapes as early in the morning as possible so they're cold, which we don't have an issue with here in Napa for the most part. It gets pretty cold at night, even if it's 100 degrees during the day. It gets down to the 50s at night. So the grapes come in pretty cold, and that's important for a couple reasons. One, the microorganisms that are present, naturally present on the skin of the grape, are not going to activate. So if there's already yeast on the skin of the grapes or bacteria, they're not going to start fermenting the wine before I've had a chance to look at it. And then two, it saves on energy because we're going to go through a period when we have the juice of the wine settling in the tank where we're going to be 50 degrees. And if we don't have to use our chillers to cool down the must, the juice, we don't use up as much energy. So bringing it in and keeping it cold helps us conserve energy as well. So that's basically what that's all about. So we harvest at night, bring it in. This wine, just like our other whites, goes, it's called the champagne method. It goes directly into the press as grape clusters to be squeezed with the press. So the press basically has a bladder inside, like a balloon, that inflates, and you can regulate the amount of pressure that you're giving it to squeeze out the juice. And so the heavier you squeeze, the harder you squeeze, of course you get more juice, especially in the beginning when the grapes are still plump with all their juice. But at some point you start getting more bitterness out of the skin of the grape. And that's something that I try to avoid. So I have to be there testing every single press load, or every single press fraction, we call it. When we jump from one pressure to the next, that's a press fraction. And so we have a program designed of what we think how we're going to press, but we have to verify all that by taste so that we get exactly what we want and we don't have to modify the flavors later on with some kind of agent that takes things away or puts things in, which is my goal as a winemaker, is to not do any of that. So I spend a lot of time at the press. It's usually a 2 to 2.5 hour cycle just pressing alone. So there's also the before part, which is filling the press. There's also the after part, which is cleaning it out. And I participate in all that, not just the fun part of tasting. And I'm looking at what's going on as the juice is coming out. I'm tasting it. I'm looking at it to see if there's a color difference. If I have to, I'll take out a pH meter and see what the acidity, how that's changing as it's going along. All of this, you know, I'm calculating in my head, the next step is going to be how am I going to ferment it based on what I'm getting out of there. And so I try to keep surprises to a minimum when it comes to what happened in the vineyard versus what I actually end up getting in the cellar. So I spend a lot of time in the vineyard so I'm not so shocked when I'm getting the juice out of the press pan. And so, like I mentioned before, we'll press it, different pressures, getting up to, you know, 1.6 bars of pressure, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it's plenty to squeeze out every last bit of juice in some cases, for depending on the varietal. And it's a hard press, but I'll cut off the press if I feel like I'm getting flavors that I don't want before getting to that high of a pressure. And so we'll settle in the tank for 24 hours. It gives me a chance to taste it, gives me a chance to analyze it, see what's going on with it chemically, and then get it ready for fermentation. So we'll move it from one tank to another to let all the solid parts that settle at the bottom of the tank that might cause my wine to smell bad or something, because there's stuff in there that causes your fermentation to get stinky, and yes, that is the technical term, and give you characters that you don't necessarily want. So we give the juice enough time to settle. We move it to another tank, make sure that we have the right amount of clarity, and at this point we're not looking for really clear juice because we want a little bit of haziness in the wine, and that helps the yeast out in its fermentation. And so we get the yeast going, and this particular wine goes 2/3 to stainless steel barrels and 1/3 to neutral French oak. So initially when we started making this wine, and I think it was 2010 was the first vintage, it was all stainless steel barrels, and that was kind of the protocol that I wanted. And as we started having used white barrels, and by that I mean that the fermentation and maybe the wood flavor was gone, I started testing out putting some of this wine in used white barrels and then blending it back with the stuff that was in stainless steel barrels. And I found that the combination of the two just made a much more profound wine. So that's kind of been the story of this wine in terms of how it's aged in the cellar and what it ferments in ever since. So it's 2/3 stainless steel barrels, so I don't get any kind of oakiness, but also keep in mind that oak is porous, so it breathes. And so as it breathes, it gives you more body into the wine. And so in the stainless steel situation, you get a leaner wine than you do in a wood situation, right? So then the wood part, 1/3 of it, of the final blend, goes into wood. And so that helps me give a little bit more body and more density to the wine. And so why stainless steel barrels? That's a really important thing to talk about for me, because when we first started making this wine, basically the trend of making un-oaked Chardonnays was really starting to take off. And so what most people were doing is they were making Chardonnays in their stainless steel tanks. So you got to think of a tank, it's kind of like the bottle, right? It's tall and it's skinny. And so a lot of the flavor, specifically for Chardonnay, when you taste the grapes, it's not a grape that by itself has a lot of flavor. So you kind of have to build that as you're making the wine during the course of the year that you're making it in the cellar. And so a lot of the stuff, I mentioned that we moved the wine off things that settle out. A lot of the stuff that we want to give the wine flavor with is still in the wine. So we keep a little haziness in there because that's got flavor elements to it. And it also helps yeast, like I mentioned before. So we take the wine off that thick part of the lees, the gross lees we call that, and that goes into the barrel for fermentation. And so as we're fermenting, it's important to keep the juice oxygenated because the yeast needs oxygen to keep going. And so we stir the barrels a little bit. And so as we're stirring it, the stuff that starts settling at the bottom of the barrel gets lifted back up. Now, if we have a tank, you know, if you think of a barrel, I'll use the water bottle instead. I won't spill it all over myself. If you think of a tank like this, right, a barrel is basically a tank on its side. And so whereas in a tank, you have this surface area of lees and you have this much wine, you don't have very much wine in contact with the lees, but you flip it over and all of a sudden you have this much more surface area that's in contact with just a lot more juice. And so that's why I decided to find these stainless steel barrels. And I think I'm the first one that did that, at least in Napa Valley, to use these stainless steel barrels to get lees contact onto the Chardonnay to give it that much more flavor and complexity and not just be a steely, fresh, acidy, thin wine. It was really important for me to be a complex wine. And so when you taste the wine, you start seeing some of this creaminess. And I even get a lot of people that think that, there might be some oak on this, or there might be some malolactic fermentation. And that's all from the lees contact, that you're getting some of the sweetness, some of this complexity into the wine. So basically after the primary fermentation is over, and that's our technical term for the alcoholic fermentation, is we top up the barrels and then we just let them sit. I stop stirring them and we let them sit for at least 8 months, 9 months, up to a year, depending on the vintage. Just let it sit on the lees. And as long as the wine continues to smell good and smell fresh, because remember I was mentioning the stuff that settles out can give it aromas that you don't want or even flavors that you don't want. You know, we're constantly monitoring it to make sure that we're not picking up anything we don't like. And the minute that we do find something we don't like, I'm going to move the wine out of the barrels off that lees that settled at the bottom of the barrel and then return it back into the barrels to continue aging for a little bit more. And so all this time, besides tasting, we're not really doing anything. We're not mixing the barrels. We're not stirring it. We're just kind of letting it sit and letting there be an interplay between the wine and the lees that's settling. And there's a little bit of scientific data about what's going on there, but nobody really understands what this exchange is, other than the result is a pretty good tasting wine with a little bit more viscosity and a little bit more complexity from it that could, you know, a little bit more sweetness, a little bit of flintiness and things like that. So that's basically how the wine is made. This is a wine that I don't necessarily age it for too long in the bottle, even though I think it will age nicely. We usually release this pretty much soon after bottling because I think it's a wine that's really, really easy to enjoy when it's young. You get a little bit more of the acidity. And when you cool the wine down, if you serve it colder, like I like to do when the wines are young, serve them a little bit colder. It's a lot more refreshing and just fun to drink when it's warm outside. So usually the release of this wine coincides with spring, summer. And it's a time to really enjoy a young wine that's at the right temperature, which is normally colder for me. Maybe, you know, I like to serve it 55, 60 degrees, so a little bit on the cold side. And then as it gets older, let it warm up a little bit, maybe more room, 68 degrees, something like that, where you start getting more of the nuances in the wine. So with that said, I mean, I talked a little bit about the flavors there already. Let's go ahead and for those of you lucky enough to have the wine, we can taste it. And I'm using the Chardonnay glass specifically because I'm a big believer in having the right glass for the right wines. Not all wines, but for certain wines for sure. But certainly Burgundy varietals and varietals that don't receive a lot of oxygen in their production, that don't have a big massive body, do really well in glasses like this that have an open top, and you can aerate them more once you've released them from the bottle. So then when you expose it to air, you start getting much more of the characteristics that the wine is supposed to have, whether as compared to if it was a taller, leaner glass with a smaller opening, you don't get as much of the aromas early on because it doesn't aerate the wine as much. So Let's go ahead and have a look. This is 2018, which is a pretty good vintage. I mean, this vineyard is pretty consistent most of the time, almost all the time, in terms of having similar characteristics from one vintage to the next, which is really good. And that's kind of what I want out of this wine, being one of our bigger production wines, bigger in quotes. And so you see the color, you know, this has been in bottle for about a year. You see the color is still what it's supposed to be. Maybe it's a little bit darker than you would think for an unoaked Chardonnay, but true to its nature of a Chardonnay, it's got the nice little balance of a little bit darker color from the portion that was aged in oak. And then when you smell it, the aroma just has a lot going on. So this is where a lot of people get confused, and they think that there might be some new oak on this, and there's, again, zero new oak, but you're getting the smell not from the oak that it was aged in. Sure, you might pick up a little bit, right? I'm not going to say that it's entirely oak-free from the neutral oak. And those barrels are like 4 or 5 years old, so they've been used a couple times, and they don't have a lot of oak. But who's to say that a little bit doesn't make its way into the wine? And for me, it's great because it adds complexity. But most of it comes, again, from this lees contact that you get in the barrel. So you smell it, and it's just got this really attractive nose. There's a little bit of apple, a little bit of pear, and it's just really kind of asking you to go ahead and taste. So let's go ahead and do that. And what you'll find is the wine has a really nice balance of acidity and density without having more of one or the other. It's just kind of like one smooth object that hits you basically on your palate. Not one thing here and one thing over there, but everything kind of together in one nice drink. And you have a lot of aromas that persist on the palate after you drink it, which is one of the things that I strive for, is to have a lot of aromas when you smell it. Maybe not like huge, powerful aromas, but there's plenty of complexity in the nose that makes it attractive. But also once you swallow it and you get the return back, you know, coming into your mouth from your throat of this aroma that just kind of lingers on your palate in your mouth. So the acidity on here, again, is soft, but it stays for a little while. It's got nice long aftertaste to it. So I think it's a wine that can pair with a lot of things. It can be enjoyed on its own, which I highly recommend. I know I'm enjoying this right now. And I hope that you guys find the time to enjoy it yourself. So that's pretty much the story of the wine. I kind of talked for a little bit, and now I'm hoping that I've got some questions that I can answer. So I'm going to take a look at my phone and see if we've got anything. So we have a question from John, and I was wondering why Pinot Noir is never blended with another varietal. Is it something unique about the varietal that allows it to not be a good blending partner with, say, Gamay, Cab Franc, etc.? So that's a really, really good question. Let's see. Let me read the second part. Can't wait to try the Chardonnay. 2017 Mira Chardonnay is so good, and I'm glad you enjoyed it because I love that wine too. Could you discuss which wines in the Mira portfolio you use whole cluster ferments for? And how does that affect the final nose and palate of the wine? Well, John, those are really, really good questions because I love using whole clusters. And so your question is basically, for me, the answer is Pinot for both, right? So the first question is, why is Pinot never blended? Pinot is such a delicate varietal that you start blending anything into it and it immediately dominates the wine. So it loses a lot of its elegance and a lot of its just kind of like ethereal quality that I think it has to it. And when I think of Pinot, I think about when you have a small candle that's lit in a dark room and how you can see it, but it's not blinding you, you know, it's just there and you might see a little bit of smoke coming out. To me, that's what Pinot is. It's very subtle, very elegant, very, a lot of times understated, but verbal and sensual at the same time. And so what ends up happening most of the time, when you add something into it, specifically a red wine, it really starts taking over and it starts changing the characteristic of that soft, easily enjoyed wine into something that's really not. So some people, when the Pinot craze really went wild several years ago, and there wasn't enough Pinot in the state to produce all the Pinot that people were demanding, they started blending in Syrah, because you know Syrah comes from an area that's not too far from Burgundy. And so they thought that would be a pretty good blend with Pinot. But in fact, if you taste those wines, they don't really taste like Pinot at all. They don't taste like Syrah either, but it's just a much bigger wine than a Pinot normally is under its 100% Pinot circumstances. And so Yeah, that's why I would never blend anything in there. The only thing that you might consider blending, and it's something that they do in Burgundy a little bit, is blending in a little bit of Chardonnay. And by a little bit, I'm talking about like 1-3%, so hardly anything. A little bit of Chardonnay, and they're kind of brothers because they come from the same place. Sometimes will help you give a little bit more depth to the Pinot in a year where the Pinot suffered in the vineyard and didn't really give you what you wanted in the winery. So I haven't had to do that here. I always experiment before I come up with the final blend just to see what could have been. And it's surprising that Chardonnay works well, a little bit of it in Pinot, especially when, if you add it towards the end. Some people in Burgundy, I know they've added as fruit into the Pinot fermenter to help maybe bind a little bit more of the color, because there's polyphenols, which is the fancy word for the elements in the skin of the grape that help you bind color. There's more polyphenols in Chardonnay that give you that bitterness that help you retain color in Pinot Noir, right? So in situations where you might not have enough color, that's a way to keep more color into it, the red color. And that's something that they do in the Rhone Valley as well with Syrah. They have Viognier planted every certain number of vines that they harvest all together, and it helps them keep the Syrah a darker color than it would have been otherwise. So those are really good questions. So the other part of that question was about whole clusters, and what was it? Which one? Where do I use whole clusters in the portfolio? So the one that we're going to taste tomorrow, the Stanley Ranch Pinot, is one that receives a fair amount of whole clusters in fermentation. So we make two Pinots. We have the actually three. We have the Hyde and Sons, and we have the Hyde Vineyard Pinot, which right now we're currently sold out of. And so on the Hyde version of the Pinots, I don't do any whole clusters. I feel like the wines are already powerful enough as it is. But on the Stanley Ranch, because it's a blend of a couple different clones, I can play around and do whole clusters here and there depending on the clone. So I'll talk more about that one tomorrow specifically, and we can get more deep into whole clusters on Pinot Noir. Other than that, I haven't really used them on any varietals around here. Syrah is a candidate for it that I might try at one point, but so far I haven't felt the need to go that route with the other red varietals. And just to give you a quick reason why not, I don't crush any of the grapes that go into the tank. It's all whole berries, and so I get kind of a carbonic effect already from having whole berries in the tank without having to have the stems. So that's basically the answer to that. So let me see what else we got. Questions here from Tom Sherry. And we are currently sampling the Mira 2014 Hyde Chardonnay. Would you please compare the flavor profiles between that and the 2018 Napa Valley Chardonnay? For sure. So these are, as I was mentioning earlier in the presentation, these come from the same grower, but two distinct areas in the valley. And they're the same clone of Chardonnay. They're both Robert Young clones. But the growing conditions in the Hyde Vineyard, which I mentioned before, is about 5 minutes away on a good day with no traffic, are such that it just produces a completely different wine. So whereas on this wine, coming from Oak Knoll Appellation, I have a much higher degree of malic acid, and it's slightly warmer here than it is in Carneros. In Carneros, I have a lot less malic acid. So just to give you an idea what a low number is, and we talk in grams per liter. In Carneros, the Chardonnay might have 1.2 grams per liter of malic acid to start off with, where this one might have 2.5, even 3 some years, which is, you know, twice as much. So think about that as it goes through malolactic fermentation. Because of this high degree of malic acid, I'd get this huge blast of butteriness in the wine, which is what I'm trying to avoid. And then the wine would just be really, really flat because I'm converting the one acid to a softer acid. Contrast that to Carneros, where the Hyde Chardonnay only has 1.2 grams per liter of malic acid. So what ends up happening is the wine still retains a lot of freshness, a higher degree of acidity, and it doesn't produce a lot of buttery character. So it still has a little bit, but just not as much as you might expect from another California Chardonnay. And so what does that mean? So without getting too much into the details of or trying to describe the difference between pH and stuff like that, chemistry, you have a wine from Carneros, the Hyde Vineyard Chardonnay, that just has a higher degree of acidity in general. And what ends up happening is that wine needs just a lot more time to develop, and the lees contact that I described in this wine helps that wine out tremendously, and the wood exposure on that wine helps it out tremendously. So for the most part, the higher degree of acidity you have, the leaner the wine is on the palate. And so on the Hyde Vineyard Chardonnay, I decided that's going to be 100% barrel fermented and barrel aged, and it goes through malolactic, so a little bit different from the Los Trancas Napa Valley Chardonnay. But the barrels in that program, typically we make about, the vineyard produces about 10 barrels worth of wine, so I'll use one new barrel per year on that wine. So again, a very, very light touch on the oak, because I'm not looking to make an oaky Chardonnay, but I'm looking to give it complexity with a little bit of oak and maybe balance out a little bit of this natural acidity that you find naturally in the wine.